The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Okay. Rock, rock, rockin' it cold. Yeah. Rock, rock, rockin' it cold. Rock, rock, rockin' it cold. But once she grabs, she won't let go. Rock, rock, rockin' it cold. Rock, rock, rockin' it cold.
None of that soft stuff.
Rock, rock.
None of that heavy metal stuff.
Rock, rock, rock,
just a little bit of jazz.
Rock, rock, rock,
ah,
I
love
that.
It. That was great. Thank
best
you.
Laid plans and all kinds of stuff. So let me tell you what's going on. All right. Chris Isaac, quiet. I had a computer meltdown this weekend, and it melted down so hard that it just is not working properly now. In fact, Marcy Wheeler, I see, joined the Zoom room, and then my Zoom crashed. And not only that, my audio streaming also crashed, so we got nothing, probably going to Progressive Voices. Trying to see if I can fix it real quick, and this is not fun. You know, wasn't fun before the day started, and it's less fun now. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to try to put on a video because, you know, we go live and it is what it is. So, and I'm trying to kill the Zoom thing so I can start it again and get Marcy in. And Marcy, if you can hear me, hold on. Hold on, I'm coming. Let me try to, and nothing is working. Oh, I love it when this happens, she says facetiously. And now everything froze. Oh, just marvelous. This is just wonderful. Well, hopefully you can hear me. Yeah. No, it's my computer. It's completely my computer. And so, no, nothing is happening here. Lovely. I got nothing streaming anywhere. All right. I'm going to try to play a video just so I can try to do things while this is, while I'm trying to get this all working. So I can't even do this. Damn it. Nothing. Okay. Oh, now I have video back. Hello. All right. So maybe. All right. So no. And now it's crashing again. I try to hit something and it crashes again. Oh my God. We may not have a show today, everybody. I'm really sorry. This is not fun. All right, you know what? Let me play something for you while I try to figure this out. I guess I'll play. Didn't I download a song? Okay, I'm gonna play a song. It'll be audio only from the parody project while I try to figure this out. Sorry, everybody. Thanks for trying to listen. Will this work? I don't know. Here we go. Okay.
Some lathered up losers were called to the zone and told to come fight for a lie that was sown as expected by noon. How the crowd it had grown. It was time to get them engaging. They'd better start moving or he'd lose the throne. So the crimes they were arranging.
Day is the day American patriots start taking down names and kicking ass.
Some senators, congressmen heeded the call. They opened the doorways and spoke on the mall. But those who got hurt weren't the ones that got called. While the battle just outside was raging, they soon broke the windows and flooded the halls for the crimes they'd been. Throughout the land,
I'm Congresswoman Lauren Boebert.
Became politicians who don't give a damn. Our rights and our freedoms are at their command, but they only care who'll be paying. Divest of these truths, come with heads in the sand, or the crimes they'll keep arranging.
So we're gonna walk down to the Capitol
because you'll never take back our country with weakness.
Some cretins and windbags who subvert through their limbs. If we don't stay vigilant, we'll just try again. And don't think too soon, Fox won't hear their spin. There's no telling who next they'll be framing. For the high flyers now, they'll say later did sin for the crimes they are arranging.
All hell is going to break loose tomorrow. It's all converging, and now we're on, as they say, the point of attack. I'll tell you this, it's not going to happen like you think it's going to happen. Okay, it's going to be quite extraordinarily different. And all I can say is strap in.
The lines have been drawn, the die has been cast. We must take a stand and not live in the past. We must do it now and we must do it fast. The time is rapidly fading. Be sure to vote soon or it could be your last. 'Cause the crimes, they are a-raging.
All right. Well, some fun music from the Parody Project, but that's about all that's fun right now. As you can tell, if you're watching the video feed, I'm having issues. I had a computer meltdown this weekend, and I spent all last night and from this morning from 5:30 a.m. on trying to rebuild this computer. And in some aspects, it works, and in some, it does not. Oops. Hold on. Let me try to figure out where this audio is coming from. And then I can bring Marcy Wheeler in. It may just be audio only. and I'm having one of those days, everybody. Hold on. Nope. Okay. There. See, it's still coming in from there. All right. Bear with me because, the story of my life. Okay. One more second. All right, I got rid of that. Now, all right. Oh, I can bring Marcy in with video. I just won't have video, but this may work. Well, for now anyway, it'll be better than what... No, and now I can't get rid of the audio there. Hold on one second. Marcy, okay, hold on, hold on. Where is this coming from? I need to mute this. Damn it. Marcy Wheeler will be joining us in just a moment. She is live in Ireland, and I actually thought it was Dublin as well, but I find out she's in Limerick, and I've got to find out if Marcy knows that about the Limericking.
Okay.
No. I think I know where it's coming from. Hold on one more second. One more second. I got too many inputs. Oh, my God. I've got all these windows open. One of these is probably giving me audio. Hold on. I'm sorry. This is just a mess. And here's your professional radio show for today. Damn it. Oh, my God. I should just turn it off now and go to sleep. All right. I think we have it. Marcy, you there?
I am.
Yay. All right. I can hear you. I can see you. You can't see me. I may try to get something working while we talk, but better than nothing. This is called flying by the skin of your teeth or the seat of your pants or some other thing that makes no sense to me anyway. Anyway, hi, Marcy. Thank you so much for being here today. I'm so sorry. This is a continuation of my weekend. So thanks for, I hope things are going better there. In Ireland.
Reasonably good.
Yeah. So you just took a vacation, huh? What's that like?
Well, my spouse can't keep track of the beautiful beaches and the castles we saw. So that's what the vacation was like.
Okay.
Castles and beaches.
Wow. Okay. Well, that sounds good. So when you're on vacation, because I know how hard you work and you keep on top of everything. So when you're on vacation, are you staying on top of what's happening in the news? Or when you got home, did you have to play catch up and figure it all out?
I spent today catching up on filings from last week. And I kept up on some things from last week, but I'm reasonably up to date. I watched everyone cover the Guy Raffet sentencing today. I wasn't there, couldn't cover it directly, but I can tell you what happened. So,
okay. Well, let's start. The big news was this one sentencing that happened today. A 3%, or I have trouble keeping track of all the different groups. There are the Proud Boys, there are the Oath Keepers, there are the 3%ers. This guy named Guy is a 3%er, yes, and he got the largest, longest sentence of anybody so far, but not as much as the prosecutors had hoped for.
Yeah, it was a difficult case. He's, like you said, a guy named Guy Raffet from Texas, who leading up to January 6th was doing more and more organizing in the context of the 3%ers, which is less formalized of a militia than the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers, but still far right and gun-oriented and militaristic and often racist and so on. So he was doing so much of that that his teenage son called the FBI and said, "I think my dad's going to do something bad." And sure enough, he armed himself, kitted out in armed, you know, a helmet and stuff, went to DC, said he was going to go hunt down both Pelosi and McConnell. And his crimes at the site of the insurrection were more amorphous. And that's what, hey, there you are.
Hey.
And so
sometimes it just takes me a little time. Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
So that's one of the reasons why the sentencing was not an easy question, I think, because he was charged. He was found guilty by a jury. His was the first jury verdict for felonies of civil disorder. So basically rioting.
Okay.
Of trespassing with a gun. He had a revolver that they found in videos. And then obstruction. This is the obstruction count that everyone, you know, that the government is using against the more serious felons. And then on top of that, after he went back to Texas and realized that the FBI was going to investigate and find the people who were responsible, he threatened his kids. He threatened to kill his kids if they went to the FBI. Now, his son at that point had already gone to the FBI. And he's, you know, at one level, there was this moment in the sentencing where the judge, a woman by the name of Dabney Friedrich, she's a Trump appointee, but a reasonable and very smart judge. And I think it mattered that she previously had been on the sentencing commission, so the people who decide how to sentence crimes, for a decade. And his case was weird. His case was like, we don't know what this is, because it's, you know, the base level felonies could have as little as 6 months incarceration to them. But there were so many aggravating factors, the threats to Pelosi and McConnell coming armed, the threats to his children, family members, the ties to the militia. And so that's what Judge Friedrich was faced with. And it went on forever and went on for 5 hours. And ultimately she sentenced him to 7.25 years, which is half of what the government had wanted, but still the longest sentence to date.
So they did float terrorism charges, but then the judge said, no, we're not going to do that, because that'll throw all the sentencing into an uproar or something.
Again, she served for a decade on the Sentencing Commission. So she was very concerned about the equity of sentencing. And she said, what about these other people who actually were charged with assaulting a cop? He wasn't. He was charged with resisting arrest with a cop. He was charged with rioting, basically, with cops. And she, you know, at one point said, well, if we used a terrorism enhancement, it would be too far separate from what other people have been charged with. But then later in the hearing, she was like, you know, he's really distinct. He really stands out among others because of all these threats and this ongoing. I mean, there was one point where a manifesto that he wrote up while he was in the DC jail with all the other incarcerated Jan Sixers. It was released, and she's like, this is you continuing to plot for insurrection from jail. And so that seems to me like a good reason to add a terrorism enhancement. But, you know, to her credit, I don't think it was an easy sentence to come up with. Mm-hmm. I was sure he wasn't going to get the 15 years the government asked for. His side asked for 2 years, which was also not going to happen. So she ended up somewhere in between. I think it probably should have been a couple years more given the sentencing that they put in the sentencing memo. But I'd have to go back and read the transcript. So talk to me in like 3 weeks.
Okay. You know, don't want to put too much on you, because I know how much you put on yourself. Again, I marvel at you keeping all this straight, because I can't, and I don't even try to digest a quarter of what you do. So Marcy Wheeler, the January 6th committee wrapped up their first season of hearings. I guess that's how we're referring to them. But we're hearing a lot of, it seems like they kicked into heavy gear in season two. I guess we'll get more hearings perhaps in September. But they're still doing the work, and there's a lot of work to do. Is this because more people are coming forward with information after the testimony of Cassidy Hutchinson and the others who were in the White House and have come forward?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But part of it, I think as well, I mean, the hearings to date have been so focused on Trump. And there are questions you need to deal with. Like, how is it that all the Secret Service officers, as well as Ken Cuccinelli, as well as Chad Wolf, how is it that all of their text messages were quote unquote wiped? Remember when there was this big scandal because the FBI cleaned phones from the Mueller team after they moved on? Well, this is yes, an institutional case of this, but when an ongoing criminal investigation was going on. So there's that. I think there are very real questions, and there have been some rumblings about a hearing focused on FBI's failures. And I think there's a great deal more attention that need. I mean, just as an example, there's a DEA agent who was arrested for going to the insurrection with his DEA issued firearm, uh-huh, and kind of showing it off, kind of flashing it all the time. And he claimed that an FBI agent had said that it was a politicized investigation and he hadn't gone beyond the barricades. And in a filing last week, the government was like, basically, he didn't tell the truth. And, mm-hmm, and it seems like he's under DOJ IG investigation for not telling the truth, for trying to protect his DEA buddy who had gone to insurrection. And honestly, you know, a lot of the people in the FBI and in the Secret Service, they were Trumpists. And so there's still a lot of that we have to unpack. I have said over and over and over again that one of the reasons the FBI didn't prepare for this adequately is because they had been trained by Trump not just not to investigate Trump's people. This is, you know, the whole point of the 6-year campaign against people who investigated him on Russia, but also because Bill Barr specifically had treated the Proud Boys as allies rather than as a militia group, mm-hmm. And so, that we know, and I talk about this incessantly because it pisses me off. Back in 2019, Roger Stone and the Proud Boys teamed up to threaten a federal judge, Amy Berman Jackson, in his case. Wow. They posted an Instagram picture of her with crosshairs on it.
Crosshairs. And, okay, that's a la Sarah Palin. Right, that's what she liked doing.
Right. And so Judge Berman Jackson had a hearing and said, where did this come from, Stone? And he named, guess who? Enrique Tarrio. So this is Enrique Tarrio and Roger Stone teaming up together to threaten an institution of the federal government, a federal judge, 2 years before the insurrection. Almost exactly 2 years. And when it came to sentencing Roger Stone, that threat Bill Barr's DOJ literally said, oh, we think that's a technicality. We think the threat of Roger Stone teaming up with the Proud Boys against a federal judge, that's a technicality. We don't want to do a sentencing enhancement for, which is ridiculous. That never happens. And then 2 years later, you know, you see it happening again. And is it a surprise that the FBI didn't pursue that if the attorney general considered that kind of threat, you know, a technicality?
Right.
And so I think that's what I hope we see more of in the fall. I mean, there's still going to be stuff. There are still things to learn about Donald Trump's role, including at critical junctures. I mean, you know, they need to crack open some of the things Mark Meadows did. They need to continue to try and get cooperation or some kind of exposure on what members of Congress did. I would like to see them try and go after Pat Cipollini's claims of executive privilege, which are bogus. And so that's where I think we'll see in the fall. And that assumes, of course, that DOJ doesn't charge any of these people and provide a lot more detail that the January 6th Commission, the January 6th Committee doesn't currently have. And there's a lot that they don't currently have. So.
Well, and now the January 6th Committee is finally turning over transcripts, the things that the Department of Justice has been asking for a long time. I think the first 20 or so or more were turned over today, perhaps. But Marcy Wheeler, this is the time I got to stop down and let you say, I told you so, because you've been telling us, and I keep coming back to you, and every time someone bitches about Merrick Garland, I said, wait a minute, Marcy Wheeler says that he's working on it, that there is an investigation, he's just not doing it out in public, but it is happening. And now we seem to know that a little bit more. He did an interview with Lester Holt last week where he said, nobody is above the law. And, you know, I don't care who Donald Trump is or if he's running for president. If you were involved in trying to overturn the results of a fair and free election, you will be prosecuted. That kind of makes your case, doesn't it?
Well, look, it has always been the case that Merrick Garland has said, we're going to go wherever the investigation leads. Mm-hmm. The complaint against Merrick Garland by a number of people is that, well, he's not starting from what I see. He's not starting from the things that I am certain are crimes, many of which, as I've pointed out, aren't. Like trying to get Jeffrey Clark, trying to replace Jeffrey Rosen with Jeffrey Clark is not necessarily a crime. It's never been considered a crime. And so that's not actually where you want to start an investigation. And DOJ has been very clear. We're going to start from the actual crimes. We're going to start from things that we know are crimes, like the invasion of the Capitol building. But it is in fact the case that those complaining may be right to some degree that DOJ didn't start at Trump, didn't start, you know, like I think where people kind of reach a middle ground is that everyone kept saying, why aren't you investigating the fake elector plot? Why aren't you investigating the fake elector plot? Why aren't you investigating the fake elector plot? Well, we learn about it, the further back in time DOJ was investigating it. It just wasn't visible. Now that investigation is becoming more and more visible. That's probably what those 20 transcripts are that are being turned over to DOJ. And frankly, you know, when people talk about the urgency, that plot has far more urgency for DOJ to come to some kind of decisions about than Trump per se, because you have people like Doug Mastriano, Doug Fincham, Carrie Lake in Arizona. These are people who may be elected to state offices, who are or may be on the ballot for November, in which case DOJ really has a shrinking window this month.
Right.
The month of August to charge them before they become the governor of Pennsylvania or something like that.
God.
So that's the really urgent issue.
And hopefully they don't. In fact, you came up with a list of the overlap between those known to be named in the DOJ warrants and subpoenas and the January 6th committee. And you do, I mean, Kelly Ward is in there, and she's Jenna Ellis, Boris Epstein, Bernie Kerik, you know, Rudy Giuliani. It blows my mind that Rudy Giuliani is still out walking around, going out. Is the hammer going to come down on him one of these days?
Yeah, one would assume so, but it's really hard to understand what DOJ is doing with him. But at least with Rudy, I mean, there can be no question that DOJ was pulling its punches with Rudy because, and I say this over and over, the very first thing Lisa Monaco did as Deputy Attorney General was approve a warrant to raid him.
Right.
Now, that warrant was, as far as we know, exclusively Ukraine. But the way in which they did the privilege review of Rudy's phones, at whatever point, and I don't know when it is, and you don't know when it is, and DOJ isn't telling us, at whatever point DOJ was able to prove to a judge they had probable cause that Rudy had committed a crime with respect to January 6th, and there's good reason to believe it was by November, at that point they had his phone contents in hand. They already had it because they had moved on this other crime earlier in April. I don't know what it means. You know, yeah, I'd be happier if I woke up tomorrow and found out that Rudy had been arrested. I think, I think with Rudy and with a number of other people, there's so much complexity built in here. And once you charge people, then you have to start giving them stuff in discovery and you don't want to disclose too much at once. It's a pretty complex thing.
Well, it's obviously all very complex, and there are so many balls to juggle and so many different aspects of this. You know, there's the January 6th stuff itself. Then everything we've learned about through the hearings. I mean, the December 18th meeting was pretty mind-blowing. And then seeing that Trump made that incendiary tweet saying, come on, it'll be wild, following that meeting. It's just, it seems like so many pieces are falling into place. Now we're waiting for the other shoes to drop.
I want to interrupt because this is actually a post that I was about to start writing and I may write in the next couple of days. That actually is one of the biggest holes in every known investigation.
Hmm.
Because what we know, and you, if you read that particular hearing carefully, the evidence, Jamie Raskin's in charge of talking about that, if you recall, the evidence that we see is we have three groups of lawyers fighting, right? Mm-hmm. And Trump's there, sort of, in Trump's fashion. You've got the Sidney Powell contingent, and they're saying, appoint me, Sidney Powell, special counsel, and we'll seize the voting machines. You've got Rudy Giuliani kind of on his own, and you've got Pat Cipollini and two other White House counsel members, and they're saying this is crazy. None of those people, none of those lawyers, not even Pat Cipollini, I think, are really credible witnesses. For example, Pat Cipollini is trying to protect the president still.
Right.
You know, he's still invoking executive privilege and as a result, not telling us the truth, which is that Trump really did appoint Sidney Powell special counsel. And then the White House made it kind of unhappen. So you've got three sets of unreliable lawyers. That's where we get the story so far.
Right.
Mark Meadows was in there, but Mark Meadows isn't talking anymore, even though he was back in real time in December 2020. We knew what Mark Meadows was doing. So we really don't know what happened in that meeting. We know that eventually the Sidney Powell contingent and the Rudy Giuliani contingent were thrown out. We don't know whether that happened at the same time or whether Rudy stayed slightly after. And that's actually a critical, critical question. And then sometime in the next 2 hours, and we have literally no visibility on this, sometime in the next 2 hours, Trump basically operationalized a plan that was already in place. And this is a contention I have with the way in which that was presented with the January 6th committee, is because we know parts of that. We know that the militias were already coordinating. They got together at the December 12th event in D.C. It was a big networking event for them. And so as soon as that tweet went out, Ali Alexander, Alex Jones, Taddeo, all of them, it's like they have a riot in a box all ready to go for that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And people like Alex Jones recognize the message that Trump sent out. And he said, this is the moment we've all been waiting for. And Alex Jones knew when he said that, the Oath Keepers would respond in a certain way. And so We don't know what happened between the moment when Rudy Giuliani was kicked out, or between the moment when Sidney Powell was kicked out and that tweet went out. And the people who do know are Mark Meadows and Dan Scavino. And they're not telling yet, okay? So, A, we actually don't know. We do not know how we get from the resolution, that quasi-resolution of the meeting, to that tweet. And whether it was something, whether it was Mark Meadows or Rudy Giuliani saying, you know, no, you can't have voting machines, but I'll give you something just as good, which is an insurrection. That, I mean, that's completely the kind of thing we know happened with Trump all the time. But we literally don't know. Right. And then, you know, it has been presented inaccurately that Peter Navarro definitely had a key part in this. And there's no evidence of that. Peter Navarro was probably not up at midnight at the White House listening to this argument and jumping in and swooping in and saying, here's the plan. The likelihood is that Peter Navarro was some excuse to move forward with the next step, and he was just an easy person sitting there. Again, we don't know who was in the room. Is it Mark Meadows? Is it Dan Scavino? Is it Roger Stone? Is it Rudy Giuliani? Is it somebody else? And that's a huge, huge question. But also, how did it operationalize something that was all set to go? How did it operationalize people who happened, oh, by the way, to be close associates of Roger Stone, Ali Alexander, right, and Alex Jones?
Right. You know, now, Marcy, you mentioned, obviously, Mark Meadows, and we don't know what's going on with him. The Justice Department decided not to indict him for contempt of Congress, but they did indict Steve Bannon, and Steve Bannon last week was convicted. Now, he doesn't get sentenced till October, which I think is absurd, but I mean, part of me, I was thinking all along, well, they've got bigger fish to fry with Mark Meadows than contempt of Congress, which I think is a possibility because he seems to be implicated in all of this. Do you think that that's a possibility, that there's something more coming from Mark Meadows?
Well, I think two things went on. One is I think DOJ, three things. One is I think DOJ believed correctly it would be a lot harder to get a conviction for Mark Meadows because he did cooperate to some degree. I think that they thought the legal question was a lot closer with Mark Meadows because DOJ's rules about, you know, who has to do what are very different if you were a top advisor of the president than if you were the flunky who had been fired back in 2017, who was just hanging around trying to, you know, grift for his podcast. Those are two different situated people. But I do think in even in Bannon's case, once he was indicted, they had to give him what they had on him and what they had on his lawyer. And I think with Mark Meadows, that would quickly put you in a position where you were exposing key parts of the investigation. Now, that said, one of the other disclosures that came out in recent weeks is that it was reported that DOJ received Mark Meadows's call records in April.
Okay.
And the way in which that was reported suggests, my guess is the best explanation for it is that DOJ got a request for his call records back in April and got a gag. And so got a 90-day gag and let the gag expire without renewing it so that Mark Meadows was informed by, say, Verizon in the last couple of weeks, oh, by the way, back in April, DOJ received your call records. Now, that's not all that interesting for Mark Meadows, for an investigation into Mark Meadows, because one, we know he used signal texts, and you're not going to get those signal texts unless you get his phone, or unless you get him to turn them over in subpoena, or unless he found some way to comply with the Presidential Records Act and provided those texts to the archives, which is where they should have been, or unless they got those texts from other people. Now, I am skeptical they have those texts in large fashion. Mark Meadows replaced his phone sometime in early 2021 at a time when a criminal investigation was ongoing, which by itself should be obstruction. But that was the first instance where we know they took steps with Mark Meadows. I just think with Mark Meadows, and even with President Trump, when you are investigating somebody who had, who was required to provide these records to the National Archives upon leaving office, you may get a bunch of records without necessarily tipping the person off. I mean, like, assume the DOJ is going to get everything that the January 6th committee asks for and got the privilege waiver from Joe Biden of. DOJ is just going to say, here's a rolling warrant for all that same information. Give it to us after you give it to them. We get it without having to tell Joe Biden what we're investigating. So, you know, I just think that there are many ways in this investigation where people are going to be getting information which isn't necessarily going to be public.
Uh-huh. There's so much. And Marcy, I got to tell you, a news alert just crossed my desktop. And and I know this is also in your wheelhouse, not related to January 6th or any of this, but I'd love to get your take on it. Here's the alert. The U.S. killed al-Qaeda leader Ayman al-Zawahiri in a drone strike over the weekend. Al-Qaeda, are they still a threat out there? Is this something that was on anybody's radar?
You know, I saw that Biden was about to make an announcement. I didn't see what it was going to be about.
That's what it is.
There was some reporting a couple of weeks ago that he was still out there and that he was still sowing, you know, extremism. Maybe that was the prep to take him out. Maybe, you know, I don't think he's in top 10 biggest threat to the United States, but.
Who knows? Right. You know, just one more thing to throw in the mix there. So, okay. So you mentioned, we talked about Mark Meadows and Steve Bannon and Rudy Giuliani and all these characters. You know, you mentioned Enrique Tarrio. He's based in Miami. And I spoke the other day with Annette Tadeo, who's running for Congress from Miami's Florida's 27th district. And we got into it a little bit over the fact that the Proud Boys have effectively taken control of the Miami-Dade Republican Executive Committee. They control the Republican Party of Miami-Dade County. This is too close for comfort. This is really dangerous. And now, you know, some of the people that you mentioned, the Kerry Lakes and the other people, are in position where they could be elected to you know, the U.S. Senate, to governor's offices, to Secretary of State's offices. These are people who went along with this coup, went along with the trying to overturn the election to the false electors scenario and all that. When you look at the big picture, how much does this frighten you?
Oh, I think it's really terrifying. I mean, that's one of the reasons I say that the urgency is on people like Kerry Lake and Doug Mastriano. One of the people in Miami who's been involved in Republican politics is a guy, Gabriel Garcia, who is he was a captain in the Army. And he's a Proud Boy. And during the insurrection, he was literally, you know, describing what was going on. And my suspicion from day one has been that he was basically given a trained captain's view of how the insurrection was going to people who, and we know, for example, that Tarrio and others, a couple of other top Proud Boys were monitoring things from afar and kind of kibitzing back in. So he's one of those guys. He's in charge, you know, he's keyed into the Republican Party in Miami. Now, you know, this is why I think it is foolish for people to say that the what I'll call the white collar side of the coup and the blue collar side of the coup, you know, the white collar is the Willard Hotel and the blue collar are the meat fighting with cops at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Roger Stone is right there. Roger Stone occupies that overlap that sees the Proud Boys come to a position of power in the Miami Republican Party. like, but obviously this is something he's done forever, and it's his neighborhood. It's your neighborhood, his neighborhood. I'm sorry that you are neighbors with Roger Stone.
You and me both.
But, and you know, you look at Doug Mastriano is the one who terrifies me the most, because he already has the nomination for governor of Pennsylvania. Yep. And because he can appoint of his own choice a secretary of state, and that secretary of state has enormous power in Pennsylvania to influence elections. And he says he already knows who it is. It could be Jenna Ellis, Rudy's sidekick, who is his counsel, his campaign counsel. He's got ties to a guy named Evan Raiklin, who sort of had ties to Mike Flynn. But those are terrifying. Because, you know, these are people who see it within their sights to end democracy as we know it, and to end democracy as we know it, and to put in basically brown shirts in charge of the local party with the kind of retaliation that you expect from brown shirts.
That's right. That's right. And now going back to the text messages from the Secret Service, and now we find out that the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security knew that they were missing, and actually months before alerting, say, the January 6th committee, he told them to stop any efforts to get those phones and to retrieve the missing texts, which we're just now learning about. This is, I mean, this to me sounds like treason. This sounds like it's a much bigger coup than we knew at the beginning.
Well, treason is a very specific crime.
True.
And
that's true.
It's not treason.
Okay.
it is, I mean, look, yeah, there were sympathizers of the insurrection, certainly within Secret Service, and certainly, you know, parts of the FBI, and certainly within local police departments, and some police departments more than others. The people within the Proud Boys, you know, there are, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 Proud Boys who are or were cops, in addition to all the former military members, right? And so we have a problem in the United States with the cops are very militarized. They're very right wing in some places, including Florida. It's hard to distinguish the white supremacists from the cops. And so it is not surprising that you would see cops being sympathetic to the Proud Boys. I mean, when the FBI first started investigating Joe Biggs's role, the FBI was like, oh my God, Joe, you prevented it from getting worse. They believed Joe had been a reliable informant in the past.
Oh,
same thing with Tario. Same thing with a key guy from Philadelphia. You know, they believed that these guys were partners of law enforcement, and that's how you have this difficulty. You know, then there's one Capitol policeman who is being prosecuted for obstruction for tipping off one of the insurrectionists that he should delete his Facebook account.
Wow.
It is a problem because the culture of policing in the United States is not all that distant from, you know, far right militia members.
It's, you know, it's terrifying, and keeping it all in perspective, it's hard to not look at the enormity of it. And now we are against the clock. So the August recess has begun for the House. The Senate is trying to get some stuff done, and then they're going to go for August. I guess some people are still working, the January 6th committee. But then they're going to come back. They say that there'll be another, at least, interim report from the January 6th committee in September or October, obviously right before the election, which they want to do it for impact. But the other part of it is, if they lose control of the House, the Democrats, and it's looking likely that they will, this committee dissolves as of what, January 6th, whatever day, January 2nd, whatever day the 118th Congress convenes. They're done. So, do you know that, can they wrap it all up in that time, or is it going to be sort of get whatever they can leading up to it and then turn it all over to justice, or do we know?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I want to push back about the notion that the Democrats are definitely going to lose the House.
Okay.
You know, I think pre-Dobbs, that was probably true. Yeah. I think that Biden is having more successes of late. I think that there has been some institutionalized naysaying about DOJ, and that could change. So I really want to push back about that, because I don't think that that is set in stone. I think that this is a completely unpredictable year.
I agree.
So, you know, the Democrats could get their rear ends handed to them in the House, or they could narrowly pull it out again.
Right. And the same thing in the Senate. It's looking more and more, I think, that they're going to retain control of the Senate. But then again, who knows?
Right. I think there is a better chance that they'll expand control in the Senate than, you know, maybe narrowly keep the House. And if they keep at least one House, then, you know, that's going to keep things sort of on, you know, in some direction.
Right.
But the important thing is, I think that the January 6th committee has always understood that they could be done next January. I think that they have renewed belief that they can expand what they get done by January, and a commitment to doing that. I mean, Liz Cheney is probably going to lose.
That's right. Right?
Yep. So she's going to be looking at, and let's be honest, Liz Cheney may well be using this as a platform to run for president in 2024 as the kind of the return of the old Republicans. And that's what Democrats have to live with if they want a partner in trying to pursue this justice. But that's she's going to give it her all. And she learned a lot. She learned how to run government from her daddy. And they have some incredibly good investigative counsels working for them. So we just have to assume that they're going to do what they can do with their time. And we have to hope that DOJ can hold off whatever happens from Congress as they continue to investigate. But there are no guarantees. We literally do not know what's going to happen over the next 2 years, three years.
And that's the frustrating part. But then again, if we knew, then we wouldn't have to be reading you.
Well, and that's why, you know, I don't want to say I told you so about DOJ investigating. That's never what this has been about.
I know.
It's been about trying to get people to see a better way to use their time than to agonizing over over Garland, because Garland is clearly investigating. You may not like it. It may not. It's not. I promise you, it will not happen quick enough for you. I mean, maybe they'll get through the fake electors that really do have a clock ticking, but everything else is not going to happen quickly enough for people's tastes. Not mine, not yours, nobody's.
No.
Promise you that. I do promise you. But all that being said, that means there are better ways to use your time to try and save democracy than to whine about Merrick Garland on Twitter. And that was my point from beginning to end. Go do something that is within your grips, whether it's, you know, take on these Proud Boys who are trying to run for local office. That's a better use of your time than going after Merrick Garland right now, because we don't have the time to waste resources.
Without a doubt. I encourage everybody to run for office, because they're putting up the craziest of the crazy to run for everything from dog catcher to school board to senator and governor. So run for something. Marcy Wheeler, I know it's really late over there. I thank you so much, and I apologize for the technical shit today.
I'm so sorry.
You know, story of my life. Anyway, I promised you, since you're in Limerick, Ireland, there is a Twitter account called Limericking. That's the name of it, Limericking. And they do limericks about news stories. So here's one from last week. Josh Hawley went out to incite the mob in D.C. with delight. He stood as their cheerer, and when they came nearer, he galloped away in a fright. So they do this with and then the next tweet is the news story that is what from whence the limerick came. So
I tried to do a limerick about Limerick someday this year. It's hard to Limerick doesn't fit into limericks very well, because what rhymes with limerick?
Limerick. Someone's a prick.
Right. Which I'm not supposed to say, you know that.
Well, come on. You have to from one potty mouth to another. Embrace it. Embrace it. Marcy Wheeler, I can't thank you enough. So appreciate it, as do my listeners. The chat room is forever in your awe. So thank you, as always.
Awesome. Great to be on, as always.
All right. Talk to you soon. Thank you again.
Next time, your computer was.
Thank you so much. Next time, I hope it'll be better. No promises. All right. Thanks, Marcy. All right. There we go. So Marcy Wheeler, she really is just, she's so good. She's such a great resource. And I'm thrilled that she comes on this show, because I learn something from her every time we talk. All right. So, I was going to tell you the postscript to Friday. So Friday, we were joined by my old friend, John Ondrasik, who is a musician. Five for Fighting is the band, right? So he had this big hit back. It was made a huge hit by the first responders of 9/11 called Superman. I was the first person to ever play it on the radio. Yes, I was an early supporter of John's, and we were good friends. We were really good friends back then. And we had a falling out some years ago. And now I'm going to tell you what it was about. And, you know, we're good, I guess. I hadn't spoken to him. Well, let me back up. Back when I adopted my daughter, you know, I adopted Allison from Kazakhstan. And a lot, now the audio is perfect, huh? Okay, so I guess it was a thing having to do with the Zoom. I don't know. I won't even try to figure it out until we're done. And tonight I'll tear it all apart again, and hopefully things will go better tomorrow. Okay, so back to Five for Fighting. So when I adopted Allison, it was 2000, basically. In fact, when I went over there, I left Los Angeles. I was still living in Los Angeles at the time. I left Los Angeles on November 18th, 2000, following the 2000 election. Remember Bush v. Gore? That was the election. All right. So when I left for Kazakhstan on the 18th of November, that election had not yet been decided. It was still in the courts, Bush v. Gore. So meanwhile, it all came together very quickly after 18 months of waiting for a referral and figuring out when I was going to travel and all that. I got the referral. It happened within like 3 weeks. I was going. So some friends threw me a big baby shower. One of the friends was Carla Ondrasik, John Ondrasik's wife. And she got donations. She raised all kinds of money and bought all kinds of donations for the orphanage. She filled me up this giant duffel bag of stuff to bring over there. But I remember at the baby shower, we were very apolitical back then, but we were all talking about what was going on with George W. Bush and Al Gore and the election and what was going to happen. And we didn't know. And it was, what a disaster. And all of a sudden, Carla very quietly says, you know, we're not all Democrats. And a hush came over the room and we realized, okay, so we're not. But Carla was the only Republican. But that seat, John and Carla had been friends of mine, but we never talked politics. And I had no idea. But after that, I learned that they are indeed Republicans. Again, not an issue. I can, well, back then, have a friend and talk with, you know, people about things other than politics. So, all right. The adoption goes through. We come home. Everything's great. Oh, I was going to pull up some pictures to show you, some pictures I found of Allison and little Johnny. And so, you know, we were friendly. Then I left L.A., right? After the 2000 election, I left L.A. I moved to Taos, New Mexico. Then I came back here to Florida. Then I moved up to the Boston area. While I was in Boston, I saw John, because that's when his now third album was coming out. I think. Yes, the one with 1,000 years on it. And he came up, he played live in my studio, and brought me the CD. I was the first one to play 100 years. Did I say 100 years or 1,000 years? 100 years. Played 100, first one to play 100 years on the radio. And like that. Fast forward some more years. Again, I'm not living in LA anymore. I don't see friends. I've lost touch with a lot of people. And do you remember Andrew Breitbart? Of course you do. Who could forget? So Andrew Breitbart was a heinous piece of crap, a right wing, just a reactionary, flame throwing, shit stirring, you know, right winger. right around the time of all the Tea Partiers and all that. He was one of the first loudmouth asshole media guys on the right. Well, not one of the first, but one of the loudest. Anyway, he actually, after I was arrested, Andrew Breitbart went on Bill Maher and name checked me and said that I was going into town hall meetings, making shit up and trying to stir up the crowd, which couldn't be further from the truth. And so I had a problem with Andrew Breitbart. I actually did a radio show with him once it was like point counterpoint, and he was just the biggest jerk ever. So not a nice guy. So Andrew Breitbart one day dies. Of course, when the news breaks in the morning, Andrew Breitbart died, I think it's a stunt because that's typical for him. And I see John, my friend John Ondrasik, tweeted out something. Oh, I lost a good friend. I'm so sorry, John. Andrew Breitbart died. And I wrote back. And I'll tell you, it was a mistake. It was wrong of me because you don't speak ill of the dead. I didn't get the memo. And I just said, he was never anything but an asshole to me. And boom, we didn't talk again for probably 5 years. And I'll tell you something. I wrote to John. I sent him an email and I apologized. And I said, you know what? That was really wrong of me. He was your friend and that was wrong. Granted, I did not like the guy, did not have a good relationship with him. In fact, I had a really bad relationship, but I shouldn't have said anything that was wrong. And he said, oh, I thank you. And still, we didn't talk. We hadn't spoken for years. And I hate that that's what tore us apart. But here's the other part. And I love John. I think his music is wonderful. I think his song, Can One Man Save the World, is great. Even though my video was blocked all weekend long because I played the video. He had nothing to do with it. That's Sony Music, apparently, who blocked me. Anyway, the video was pulled out of the show. It's posted on the website, and the video is now watchable again if you want to watch it. But bottom line is, our friendship ended over politics. And, you know, the reason that so many of us on the left didn't know about his story, didn't know about the song, didn't know that he went over to Ukraine to film this video with the Ukrainian orchestra is because he was all over Fox. He went on every show on Fox. He went on Sean Hannity's radio show. He went on whoever those people are. I don't even know. And you know, John's like, oh yeah, you know, send me the link and I'll tweet it out. He didn't tweet it out. He tweeted out the day on Friday when he did my show, because we taped it on Thursday, that he was doing Sean Hannity's radio show that day. And here's the other thing. I emailed him. I emailed him about the video being blocked and, you know, saying, well, shit happens. You know, I know it wasn't his fault, and saying I was going to remove it. And once it is removed, then I can post the video again. But I said, but you know, one of these days I would like to have a good civilized conversation with you about politics. Here's my question. You can't be okay with the Republicans taking out their anger over, you know, the Democrats finally getting one over on them by penalizing veterans. The veterans who need health care because they've been exposed to those burn pits. You can't be okay with that. Well, he wrote me back about the video and just ignored that question. So, you know, I realize time moves on. I love Carla, and I have great affection for John, and I love his music. I just think politically, he's got it all wrong. Just got it all wrong. And I don't know how somebody who has warmth and compassion for people can be a Republican. So anyway, that's that. So I didn't want to tell you that on Friday because I didn't want to take away from the message, and I thought we can rise above politics. But the fact that he didn't answer that question in the email really pissed me off. And I asked him twice. So there you have it. It's a shame. And I did. He asked me if I'd reach out to Ben Harper to join in his idea of sort of a live aid to benefit the people of Ukraine. And I did. But he's not going to have a lot of luck with it because most artists, most musical artists, at least the quality ones, think like you and me and not like him. So anyway, that's that. I will do my best to get this computer running as it should be running overnight. And we'll try it again tomorrow. All right. Thanks for bearing with me today. Yeah, you have no idea. It's been a long day. Like I said, I got on the phone with Microsoft at 5:30 this morning. Well, actually not on the phone, on chat, because they don't do the phone anymore. Oy. All right. Let me leave you with the news, and I'll see you tomorrow. Hopefully. Fingers crossed. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Welcome to August. The Senate is in session today. The House is in recess, and President Joe Biden is in quarantine again after testing positive for COVID-19, the rebound. But we'll begin today with the Inflation Reduction Act. That's the name of the $740 billion package put together by Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and Senator Joe Manchin. Now, there's a whole lot to be done before they can even think about bringing it to the floor for a full vote. First up, the birdbath. Now, since the Democrats want to push this through using reconciliation, so it needs only a simple majority, as all Senate legislation should be passed, by the way, it must go through a technical review by the Senate parliamentarian, Elizabeth McDonough. Some Democratic aides say that the Senate could take up the bill later this week, pointing to a vote-o-rama running into the weekend. Schumer has warned his caucus that this may happen. But perhaps the bigger hurdle comes in the form of Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. Yeah, she was left out of the negotiations between Manchin and Schumer, but so was everybody else. But apparently she's not happy. She was caught completely off guard by the announcement, particularly the inclusion of a provision that narrows the so-called carried interest loophole, something that she has always insisted remain intact. Now, this provision would bring in $14 billion of the bill's $739 billion in new revenues that it needs, something they could conceivably do without to give Ms. Sinema the win she'll require to get on board. That's ever so slightly more mature than how the Republicans are reacting. They're like children holding their breath until the veterans' faces turn blue. You know what happened, right? Last week, Senate Republicans blocked the passage of the PACT Act, which would expand healthcare access to veterans exposed to burn pits. And it's legislation that they've passed many times before with big bipartisan margins. Now they're saying the reason they held this up is because there was a Pat Toomey amendment they wanted to vote on. That's just simply not true. Nothing significant has changed in the bill from the last time when 25 other Republicans voted for it back in June. The only thing that's changed is that Schumer and Manchin cut a deal on a reconciliation package, and that caught the Republicans by surprise. John Cornyn and company don't like to be made to look foolish, and that's what it is. Now, after outcry from veterans groups, John Cornyn said he will vote for the bill, and Chuck Schumer said he's offered Toomey an amendment vote as well. Stay tuned. I think we'll still see some Republican faces turn blue. Now, the House is on recess. They passed this already. But before they went on recess, they did something they haven't done in decades. They passed the assault weapons ban of 2022. The legislation seeks to regulate assault weapons to ensure that the right to keep and bear arms is not unlimited and for other purposes. It passed very narrowly, 217 to 213, with five notable Democratic votes defecting. They were Congressman Ron Kind, Kurt Schrader, who's already lost in a primary for his reelection bid, Vicente Gonzalez, Jared Golden, and Henry Cuellar of Texas. Of course he did. Henry Cuellar, by the way, took to Twitter to announce that he voted for a bill that would ban Americans from owning lions and tigers. But guns, they're okay. Oh my. severe weather impacting much of the nation today. Heavy rain led to widespread flooding in eastern Kentucky, and Governor Andy Beshear said the flooding there is certainly the deadliest he's seen in his lifetime. At least 30 people are dead, and rescue workers continue to search for those who are missing. Hundreds of people have lost everything they have, and the governor expects the death toll to continue rising. Out in California, the McKinney Fire is now the state's largest this year so far. It began Friday afternoon in the Klamath National Forest and quickly spread. It burned 300 acres as of Friday night. By Sunday morning, that was 51,468 acres, 0% contained, with about 2,000 people having been forced to evacuate their homes. Governor Gavin Newsom on Saturday declared a state of emergency. It's not going to get better unless and until we do something about it. Just saying. Couple of sad and notable deaths this weekend. Basketball legend Bill Russell, who led the Boston Celtics to 11 NBA championships over 13 years, died Sunday. He was also the first Black head coach of any pro sports team in the U.S. and was probably as well known as an outspoken civil rights activist as he was an athlete. In 2011, then-President Barack Obama awarded Bill Russell with the Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. Bill Russell was 88. And on Sunday, we lost Nichelle Nichols, better known to millions of Star Trek fans as Lieutenant Uhura. Her role was groundbreaking in the 60s. She showed a Black woman in a position of authority, and with William Shatner, shared one of the very first interracial kisses on primetime television. Nichelle Nichols was 89. And someone's happy today. One winning ticket was sold in the $1.3 billion Mega Millions jackpot. It was sold at a gas station in DePlain, Illinois. And we may never know who the winner was because they can request to stay anonymous. So there's that. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.